Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. The Bishop and the Butterfly, Murder, Politics, and the End of the Jazz Age by Michael Wohlreich. In 1923, Vivian Gordon, a stage mother in her early 30s, was arrested and convicted in New York City for vagrancy, part of a vast entrapment scheme that had ruined the lives of hundreds of women and enriched scores of cops, lawyers, and court officials. It was a conveniently vague charge, a legal catch-all that included alcoholism and prostitution. In Gordon's case, she alleged her ex-husband, who sought sole custody of their daughter, had persuaded a corrupt police officer to frame her. Unable to afford the requisite bribes, Gordon, real name Benita Franklin Bischoff, spent much of the next 2.5 years in the New York State Reformatory for Women under appalling circumstances. In 1931, Gordon threatened to turn whistleblower. She had information in connection with a frame-up by a police officer, she had written to investigators. Soon after, her body was found in Van Cortlandt Park. She had been strangled with a rope. As recounted by the journalist and biographer Michael Wohlreich, the murder of this Broadway butterfly, as she was known in the press, did not just provide salacious copy. It also launched a wave of investigations that exposed virulent corruption all the way to the top of the city's and state's leadership, and in the process dealt a death blow to Tammany Hall, which had maintained a vice-like grip on New York politics for a century. Wohlreich's account of the murder and the ensuing investigations, helmed by the former judge Samuel Seabury, the famously upright bishop in the book's title, he was descended from generations of clergy, is brick-dense yet propulsive. Unlike the sensationalist reporters of the era, Wohlreich manages to handle even the seediest of underworlds with repertorial spareness and elegance, treating his material more as a nonfiction political thriller than a true crime whodunit. Wohlreich is well-versed in the period. His previous subjects include Theodore Roosevelt. Wohlreich argues that the successes of the Seabury investigations owed as much to timing as they did to its principled leader. The inquest might have been scorned during the devil-may-care 1920s, but by 1931, the mood in the city had darkened considerably, as New Yorkers, angry about escalating crime and spiraling poverty, demanded accountability of their leaders. Many were crying out for a savior, Wohlreich writes, and Seabury's righteous dignity inspired trust in the depths of the Depression. Different times call for different heroes. The city's once beloved freewheeling mayor, Jimmy Walker, would be one of Seabury's most prominent casualties. The book also provides a fascinating portrait of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then New York's governor, as he navigated the fallout from Gordon's murder and the public's demands to clean up the state's snake's nests. The longer her killer remained free, the greater the threat to his presidential ambitions, writes Wohlreich, an equal threat getting steamrolled by furious Tammany bosses whose continued support Roosevelt needed, even as his investigator was attacking their political machine. In this respect, the account serves as a disquieting reminder of how tragedy can be used to effect change, but also how it is often leveraged for advancement. Although the case was initially a political headache for Roosevelt, he was ultimately able to use it to his advantage. Equally unnerving is the book's reminder of how infrequently and unevenly justice is meted out. While Wohlreich justifiably marvels that Gordon's murder led to the collapse of Tammany, this posthumous triumph was qualified by the fact that Gordon's actual killers were exonerated by a jury. Countless women had seen their lives ruined by a nefarious system that had operated with impunity for years. The Gordon murder and Seabury hearings might have long since faded from public memory, but their prism into corruption and ruthless opportunism remains ever relevant. This review was written by Leslie M.M. Bloom, who is a journalist and historian and the author of Fallout, the Hiroshima Cover-Up, and the reporter who revealed it to the world. Corey Fa Does Social Mobility by Isabel Wadner. In the first few pages of Isabel Wadner's new novel, Corey Fa Does Social Mobility, our titular character learns that they've won the award for the fictionalization of social evils, a literary prize that comes with a substantial cash purse, which Corey, a working-class writer who lives in a social housing estate, desperately needs, and enormous prestige, which, according to the prize committee, is even more valuable than money. To secure these bounties, all Corey has to do is collect the award trophy. But the trophy doesn't look like a trophy. It's a neon beige UFO, and to make matters worse, it's disappeared, possibly into a wormhole. The prize committee is less than helpful when Corey asks for assistance. The assumption had been that a winner would know how to collect. That prize culture etiquette, its unwritten rules and regulations, would be second nature to them, Corey reflects. But Corey doesn't know how to collect, and the unwritten rules and regulations aren't second nature to them. I'd not won an award before, and neither had anybody I knew. This is the paradox that drives Corey Fa Does Social Mobility. A person needs to already have social and financial capital in order to get social and financial capital. We follow Corey, their loving partner Drew, and their mutant charge Bambi Pavok, an arachnoid creature with deer-like qualities who crawled out of another dimension and sometimes stays with Corey and Drew in furious pursuit of this confounding trophy. They drive into wormholes, explore alternate universes and timelines, even appear on and eventually host a popular wormhole-focused reality show, all in the hopes of catching the coveted prize before the judges change their minds. It feels, in the best way, like a spirited romp through someone else's stress stream. Sometimes surreal satires can be inaccessible, too clinically strange to connect with. But Wadner anchors the reader with familiar emotion, the discomfort Corey feels in the warmth of Drew's unconditional love, the way Corey handles Bambi Pavok with a tenderness that neither the arachnoid creature nor Corey has ever experienced before. In a world full of wormholes and neon beige UFO trophies, these relationships seem heartbreakingly real. Wadner's humor is similarly accessible, playful, and unpretentious, and their prose, despite being peppered with foreign phrases and grammatical oddities, is disarmingly smooth. But working hard just beneath the surface of this feisty, funny, and easily digestible insanity are bigger ideas about who deserves to be rescued from tough circumstances and why. What happens if the person in need of assistance doesn't match the image of a model recipient? Though Corey Fa is a critique of the literary world, it's easy to apply the novel's commentary to other higher-stakes systems. Corey's attempts to make sense of the literary funhouse they've been thrust into will remind some readers of, for instance, the challenges low-income students face when they are granted admission to Ivy League schools but are not given the support they need to successfully navigate those rarefied spaces. The novel is an allegory that argues effectively that admission is not the same thing as access. Even though Corey has managed to hustle and, in the end, earn recognition from a lofty literary organization, the award and all the money and prestige that come with it still evades them. Which is to say, Corey has bent and contorted themselves into big and small, but it's still not enough. And as the narrative comes to its wild end, Wadner conveys quite poignantly that a person has no other choice in this life but to be true to themselves. This review was written by Ainsley Hogarth, who is the author of Mothering, The Boy Meets Girl Massacre, The Lonely, and, most recently, Normal Women. Redwood Court by Delana R.A. Dameron. The vibrant, chatty opening of Delana R.A. Dameron's debut novel, Redwood Court, provides an early hint at the feel-good core of this coming-of-age story set in Columbia, South Carolina. But the book delivers more than nostalgia. Early in the story, Mika, Dameron's young protagonist, wonders, what am I made of? Assigned a school report on emigration and the origins of her own family, she grapples with an elemental truth of American life. Many Southern Black families like hers may never know the exact provenance of enslaved ancestors who were brought forcibly from distant shores. Mika's grandfather, a Korean War veteran, tells her that if you go that far back, it's not about blood relations so much as a matter of who brought up who protected who survived with who. The narrative revolves around Mika's formative years in the 1990s and 2000s, with flashbacks to earlier periods delivered primarily through the eyes of her elders. As a young couple, Mika's grandparents, Tita and Wheezy, left their meager rural upbringings behind, took out a mortgage on a home on Redwood Court, complete with magnolia and eucalyptus trees, and moved into paradise. Mika lives elsewhere with her parents and sister, but she spends a great deal of time at her grandparents' house. Dameron is a prize-winning poet, and it shows. She does a beautiful job weaving in local vernacular and casting a fresh gaze on an engaging, though flawed, cast of characters. Her richly textured narrative includes backyard cookouts and flea market days, while weaving a complicated, occasionally devastating reality. Some of her most affecting scenes revolve around the experiences of Mika's parents and grandparents, the loss of a child, the trauma of wartime carnage, the financial toll of a son's jail time. But we also see healing properties of spending time with the grands, as they call the younger generation. The bond between Mika and her beloved grandfather leads to poignant reflections on a theme close to my own heart, the power of relationships to shape one's identity. Troubled by his experiences in the war, Tita doesn't believe he has much left emotionally to offer his family, who would love him. He finds part of the answer in his granddaughter and her obvious delight in his company. As Tita teaches Mika to ride a bicycle without training wheels, a memory surfaces. He didn't often remember too much from his own childhood, outside of walking up and down the forever rows of tobacco leaves. But he remembered the moment his father set him on a bike and pushed him into a new experience. Tita imagines that if he were to die the next day, Mika would always get on a bike and remember he taught her how to move forward. We see how their relationship and his connection to his son-in-law bring out the best in Tita. They also expand Wheezy's view of him. Dameron's fondness for her own South Carolina upbringing is evident as she writes with a delicate touch about the challenges facing the people in her book, including racism, which presses steadily on the lives of Mika's family and neighbors. There are microaggressions from white teachers and store clerks. There are artificially inflated loan rates. There's the suppression of voter rights. For Mika's grandmother, community is a salve for life's wounds. Redwood Court is, as Wheezy calls it, our own corner of the world, a sanctuary where people can flourish. Is it our corner of the world, or a ghetto that white folks want to corral us into, like them concentration camps? A cousin asks. The novel shows how far Mika's family will go to protect people they care for, whether or not they're blood relatives. Strengthened by telephone gab fests, collect calls from prison, and fundraisers for neighbors going through hard times, these bonds form the backbone of who Mika turns out to be. Redwood Court is enlivened by fishing trip chaos and the smell of chitlins and music from the car radio, including the classic rock Mika's sister prefers in a family that favors Motown. Mika's love for the family is evident, but as she matures, holding on to her signature blend of sass and curiosity, she comes to see that even those close to her can cause deep disappointment. This novel delivers the kind of choral experience that I have savored in books as disparate as James McBride's The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store and Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kitteridge. Reading Redwood Court feels like wandering down a street, stopping to listen to different voices for better and for worse. At the end of that road is Mika, still striving to understand what she is made of, but sensing that part of the answer is rooted in that chorus of voices. This review was written by Charmaine Wilkerson. She is the author of Black Cake. Greta and Walden by Rebecca K. Riley. Labels and tropes have always been a part of the book world, but recently it feels like they've gained new prominence. Tags like enemies to lovers, morally gray heroes, found family narrative, etc. are everywhere now, especially online. Neatly classifying books has become all the rage. Greta and Walden, Rebecca K. Riley's generous, tender debut novel of family and self-acceptance, however, is not so easily pigeonholed. Greta and Walden are queer, 20-something siblings living in Auckland, New Zealand, alongside their Maori Russian Catalonian family, the Vladislavjeviks. Greta is a whip-smart yet anxious student and tutor struggling in love. Walden, a former physicist with OCD, hosts a TV travel show. He is melancholic after a breakup with his ex, Zabi, who moved to Argentina and also happens to be his uncle's husband's brother. Yes, it's messy. The story follows the duo in alternating first-person chapters as they navigate bad dates, bouts of insecurity, and even encounters with racism, and as they come closer to understanding themselves and their desires. A vast array of characters, family dramas, and secrets propel the novel, but its plot seems almost secondary to the siblings' daily lives. Greta and Walden are self-conscious in the most 21st century sense. It's as if they are forever deciding what dating app bio or hashtag might suit them. Their identities are tied to a type of chronically online self-portrait. Riley writes this with a simplicity that captures the internet-fueled relentlessness of their thoughts. I download Grindr. I delete Grindr. I download Tinder, Walden thinks one panicked evening. When Greta meets a love interest, Elle, she formulates a sort of hypothetical profile to gauge their compatibility. Her favorite Boney M. song was Rasputin. Her favorite Christmas movie is either Gremlins or Elf. The place she'd least like to go on holiday is South Sudan. This kind of scrutiny feels faithful to the exhaustion of being young and online. The members of the delightfully hodgepodge multicultural Vladislavjevic family are very different from one another, but they share a few key qualities. They're all eccentric and tough, and many are queer. The novel is most lovable when the family's dynamic is explored. You can't help wanting to pull up a chair when they gather around the dinner table. We're all strange, romantic, emotional people in this family, Greta and Walden's father, Lynch, muses. Queerness is not only accepted in the clan, it's practically the norm. When Greta and Walden's nephew, Tang, reveals he is in love with a boy, the moment is radically anticlimactic. Tang is not scared to reveal his same-sex attraction. He's nervous to express his interest in monogamy. I think I might be a monogamist, Tang confesses. He says this as if this is a thing to come out as, Greta thinks. I feel stressed. The modern world is too much for me. It's just one example of how Riley subverts our expectations and prompts us to think twice before rushing to judgment. Greta and Walden is so brimming with life, it can feel almost dizzying. Sexualities, brands, locations, and political takes whirl as if scrolling 20 strangers' social media feeds simultaneously. It can be difficult to keep up as threads of family lore untangle. There are untranslated bursts of Te Reo Maori, Spanish, and other languages sprinkled throughout the novel. But Riley isn't interested in spoon-feeding her reader. We are encouraged to simply accept what we don't understand and meet the world where it is, rather than trying to seamlessly decode it. I don't always love to think about all the tiny pieces of me that add up to make a whole person, Greta remarks at one point. It's a fitting observation. Riley's warm, overflowing novel defies characterization because its characters are too complex and multifaceted to be easily summed up. They're too alive in their messiness. If this novel shows us anything, it's that love of family, of romantic partners, of community, is most joyful when it's without limits. This review was written by Eleanor Dunn, who is an international staff editor at The Times. The Women by Kristen Hanna. A few chapters into The Women, I experienced a wave of déjà vu. If you grew up in the 1980s, the Vietnam Redemption arc was imprinted on your gray matter by a stampede of young novelists and filmmakers coming to grips with their foundational trauma, patriotic innocence shattered by the barbarity of jungle warfare, the return home to a hostile nation, the chasm of despair and addiction, and finally the healing power of activism. This was the generational narrative told and retold in classics like Born on the 4th of July and The Things They Carried, The Ballad of the Boomer, a masculine coming-of-age cri de coeur. Now Kristen Hanna takes up the Vietnam epic and recenters the story on the experience of women, in this instance, the military nurses who worked under fire on bases and in field hospitals to patch soldiers back together or not. Their familiar beats snare you from the outset. When the sheltered San Diego debutante, Francis Frankie McGrath's adored older brother, is killed in action in 1966, she's inspired to enlist as an Army nurse. Women can be heroes too, her brother's friend tells her. Frankie laughs. Her flag-waving, emotionally constipated parents are not amused. Dumped in country without adequate training, Frankie learns the ropes from seasoned nurses and battle-scarred male doctors who propel her past internalized insecurities with barks of no-nonsense encouragement. Damn it, McGrath, we don't have time for fear. You're good enough. Do it. Indeed, there's something special about Frankie. Within months, she becomes an experienced trauma nurse, confronts the horrors of gut wounds and napalm with courage and compassion, rages against the naive indifference of her family and friends back home, and attracts the devotion of handsome, tormented, unexpectedly married men. Hanna is in top form here, plunging the reader into the chaotic miseries of the combat zone. She deploys details to visceral effect, whether Frankie's performing an emergency tracheotomy during mortar attack or sipping Fresca in the O Club afterward, while an evocative soundtrack of The Doors, The Beatles, and The Turtles plays in the background. Music followed the smoke, infusing it with memories of home. With Hanna confidently in control, we swoop above the jungle canopy in a Huey chopper, peppered by sniper fire, and skid across the Mekong Delta in a pair of water skis. But Hannah's real superpower is her ability to hook you along from catastrophe to catastrophe, sometimes peering between your fingers because you simply cannot give up on her characters. In the end, I was struck not by the way The Women radically reshapes the contours of our Vietnam narrative, but instead by how vividly the novel affirms them. Hanna may not offer any revolutionary takes on the war and its aftermath, but she gathers women into the experience with moving conviction, and maybe this story's time has come again. Over dinner one night, I described The Women to my college-aged daughter, a young woman with her finger on the cultural pulse, and she perked right up. "Wow, the Vietnam War," she said. "You don't see much about that." This review was written by Beatriz Williams, whose latest novel is The Beach at Summerlee. Against the World, Anti-Globalism and Mass Politics Between the World Wars by Tara Zara. A historian takes stock of the increased fluidity of money, people, products, and ideas across borders in the first half of the 20th century, along with the anxieties such movement caused, which she argues led to a global rise in nationalism rather than internationalism. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.